Excuse me for being so slow. My name is Michael Earle, and I'm a female alcoholic.
Hi, Michael.
And it's wonderful to be here this morning. It's wonderful to be back at Woodstock, especially with all my favorite speakers. And that's the truth. I'm with all my favorite speakers. Anyway, so I'm going to share a little bit about my story and then a little bit on 10 and 11. Probably more on 10, and Polly will do more on 11. She's much more spiritual than I am. When I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 31 years ago, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare, and I was reduced to prostitution. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. I never took a drink till I was 25 because I always swore I was never going to be an alcoholic like my mom. When I finally took that drink, I immediately went downhill. If you can believe that. I want to share a little story with you, just a little story. It's the greatest description I've heard in a long time on female alcoholics. And this is not my sponsee. I sponsor Lynn, and I don't know where she is. She's in here, but this is a woman that she sponsored. Anyway, this woman called her up and said she was ready to go to detox. Would she please come and get her? And so Lynn said, yeah, I'll be there within an hour or something. And so when Lynn got there, the lady in the meantime had decided she better go to the liquor store and stock up. So her house was full when she got out of detox. And that makes perfect sense to me. Thank you. Woo! But the thing that just cracked me up is every time she drinks, she loses control of her bladder. So she has learned to wear Depends if she's drinking. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, those are grown-up diapers. Depends. So anyway, she's getting out of the cab. She took the cab to get her alcohol. She's getting out of the cab. She's trying to unload her alcohol, and Lynn pulls up. And Lynn's just, she just wants to be a service, so she decided she might as well help her carry the alcohol upstairs. But anyway, so this girl bent over. This girl bent over to pick up one of the bags, and Lynn could see her Depends and that they were clearly full. But what gets me is she had a thong over her Depends. Oh, my gosh. it still cracks me up when I think about it. So that's the kind of alcoholic I am. Truly. Oh, gosh. You know, my mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort, different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is today that very same psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through their religious effort, different times in different congregations, but the result was the same. And believe it or not, today that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to just joke around and say, I think we probably drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with a psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. And that's my only qualification for being a Sunday morning spiritual speaker. Only in AA would they appreciate that. But, you know, my childhood is pretty appalling, so my mom's defense, I just want to tell you a little bit about her childhood, because as bad as mine was, my mom's was worse. So this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. I lost my mom almost 20 years ago. She died of lung cancer, and I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. My sister and I took her home. We had hospice come in, and my mom actually got to die with a little bit of dignity. I had the ability to get in bed with her, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch her drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've done. But one thing I learned from this experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things I didn't want to be like, I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities that I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drug slit my grandmother's throat. And my grandfather was on a chain gang. That's kind of like prison. I don't really understand it, but he was on a chain gang. So that left my mom out in the streets trying to raise herself at the age of 13. She had her first baby when she was 14, which she gave up for adoption, and then she had me, and she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met a man, got married, had three boys, and we all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepdad moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids. And we were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephone turned off, being evicted, having to sleep in cars. And I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with all of her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again, and this time she sent my three brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers are my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars and you're always being evicted, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those were feelings of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all the poverty. The drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My three brothers went away. And my mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I have always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, first I learned that feelings are not facts. And all those things I used to think about myself were not the truth. But best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And, you know, I walked through one of my biggest fears this last 20 years, and it's getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years of sobriety to finally get on an airplane. And I found out I'm not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. Now, my sponsor told me I'd better be clear on what the fear was when I was asking God to remove it. But I hear things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not in the big book, you know, and it's somebody's opinion. Everybody has opinions. I have opinions, and I express opinions from the podium. If I quote a page number, I want you to know you can take it to the bank. Other than that, it's just my opinion, my experience, strength, and hope. And you can just toss it. It means nothing to anybody but to me. But the one thing I used to hear all the time, and I have to tell you, it's dangerous up here at the podium sometimes. Newcomers have this wild idea that you're really something special or something. I don't know, they take what you say to heart, and it can do a lot of damage. We really need to be careful what we say from the podium and practice the tradition. We have no opinion on outside issues, because I've heard speakers up here talking about outside issues, playing doctor, attorney, I mean, other parts other than sponsor from the podium, and I have seen damage done from it. So, anyway, I didn't mean to go off on that tangent. The one thing I used to hear all the time in Long Beach is you could not have fear and faith at the same time. If you have fear, you didn't have any faith. And I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in this program, because I'd worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. I had spiritual experiences, but I still had all this fear. You know, and I went up to this man that used to talk about it all the time, and I said, what am I doing wrong in my program? And he said, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Well, today I know I have taken a thorough third step. To me, the third step's a process. It's not just saying words. I mean, it's a process. For me to do a thorough third step, I might say the prayer, and I might make the continue to start doing the rest of the steps, but I'm not actually taking the action until I put pen to paper and start on my step four. 4 through 9 to me is turning my will and my life over to the care of God. Because I'll tell you, that's not my will. There's one thing I don't want to do, it's 4 through 9. Anyway, I went up to one of the old timers in the Long Beach area that was really instrumental in my sobriety. He's deceased now. We had two brothers, Frank and Bill Honeycutt. Polly and I, just, did you know Bill? Yeah, Bill died in 1987, but he was really a powerful influence. I went up to him and I was crying on his shoulder and I was saying, this man said I've been taking a throw a third step because I'm still afraid. And I think I was really trying to tattle on him is what I was trying to do. And basically what Bill said, he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it tell you you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He pointed out a page to me, a sentence on a page, and the page is 68. And, of course, it's under the fear inventory. And that sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me that you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And then he took me to the bottom of that paragraph, and it gives you that little fear prayer. God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm always directed to work with another person to help somebody, whether they're in the program or out of the program. And for some reason, that just puts that fear at bay, and God can get in there and take care of whatever needs to be taken care of. That's how I used to get on airplanes when I first started flying in AA. Terrified, just terrified. The first time I had to fly, I just had a huge panic attack, you know, at the airport. It was LAX, and it was 6 in the morning, and I just collapsed in a chair, and I had an inner voice talk to me, and it wasn't real sympathetic either. It said, Michael, why don't you just get out of yourself and try and help somebody? And I'm looking around, and I'm trying to figure out, who in the world can I help? This isn't an AA meeting. And then I noticed that at the escalator, there were some little old ladies, much like I am today. I can't believe it. I'm going to cry. Little old ladies struggling with their bags, trying to get their bags up this escalator. And so that's what I did for I don't know how many years. I'd run over there and start helping these little old ladies with their bags, getting them up to where the planes were. Once this lady didn't know I was trying to be helpful, she hit me with her purse. So that was an experience of its own. But anyway, and what I do a lot of the time when I'm in fear and I cannot help somebody, there's no one to help, like in turbulence on an airplane, I always carry pen and paper, and I start writing out the third step prayer, and I'll put somebody else in it. Somebody that I know is struggling. You know, like, God, I offer Lynn to thee to build with her and do with her as thou wilt. And I'll have pages and pages written by the time we land. But we always land. I'm still here. So it's something that works for me. Anyway, when I was 13, my mom did have this baby, and I had to learn how to be a mom, and I didn't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never, ever around, and I had full responsibility of this little baby. And this little baby sleeping in a dresser drawer, I eventually had to potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. I found out after doing my inventory that I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. So specifically to get out of my home life at age 15, I got married. The man I married was 18. He lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. And I like to brag about this. I think it's very important that everyone in this room know that when I got married at age 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I truly did. I had these two TV shows. They were my favorite programs, and most of you are too young to remember these shows, but it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. And they were ridiculous. I mean, she vacuumed in 4-inch heels and a big fluffy dress, you know. But I didn't realize how ridiculous it was. All I know is it gave me high morals and high values my whole life growing up. All I knew is when I grew up, I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I didn't want a prostitute like my mom. And so when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed, marrying Mr. Father Knows Best. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. I believe this man was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. I should have had a clue, but I want to share a quick story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer, because when I got to this program, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism. I used to blame the way I turned out on the way I was raised. After I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine because she came from the very same background. In fact, I would say her childhood was worse because my mom's disease had progressed. And she was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test, and she had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt, under special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay. She bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach. And I guess 15 years ago, at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. You know, even today, I still don't get it. You know, same mom, same background, but different reactions. You know, and the difference is my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility, and I can no longer blame all those people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic, and I do have a disease, but today I have a solution. And for me, a big part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions, and my present actions. And I'm going to tell you one thing that I would like to have shared on the panel yesterday about my sister. I just mostly talked about the drunks. Everyone was a drunk except for my sister. But I was speaking at the Pacific Group. That's Clancy's group. It was two months after my mom had died. And I'm still really rattled from this. And, you know, I wasn't really excited about speaking at that group. I was more terrified than anything. And so my sister went with me. And she had a van, and a bunch of the people from my area went with me. So we had a whole van full of people. But they had my sister sit up in the very front row with me. And I don't know, it's between 1,300 and 1,700 people every week at this meeting. Back then, I don't know about now. And everyone came up to my sister, and they were so friendly. And at the Pacific Group, everybody dresses, they wear their sobriety, is what they do, and laugh and smile. And it just has an atmosphere of joy. That's the only way I can explain it. And I got up there from the podium. And when I was sharing about graduating from high school in 1985, I had to go back to high school. I couldn't pass the GED, so I had to go back to high school. And I was 36, and I graduated with a Catholic gown and real ceremony. And when I was sharing that, I looked at my sister, and she had these tears just streaming down her face. And after I got done talking, and I sat back down, and she just looked at me, and she says, "I wish to God I was an alcoholic." I mean, what? I just think what overwhelming it just made. I was overwhelmed. And I'm so glad that she went to that meeting with me so she could see what we're really like. Because you just go by what my family was like. It was pretty bad. But she got to see what sobriety was like, and it made me real proud to be part of this program. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program, and this was the equivalent to one that Bill had in Bill's story. Now, in the big book, it says, as a result of spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in psyche, a change in attitude. It says you'll have this huge emotional displacement rearrangement. And the spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to achieve that. And I believe it's because I did not have a plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did with this experience is I went to this church. I counseled with this minister. I told him all about my spiritual experience. I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. And he assured me if I got really active in this church and I read all these inspirational books and did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got to this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I'm absolute proof of that because I got really active in that church. I became secretary of that church. I struggled reading those books because I could barely read. I did all that positive thinking, all those affirmations. And the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister. And it absolutely infuriated his wife. The rest of the congregation wasn't too excited about it either. But the thing I'm going to share with you now is a thing I thought I'd take to the grave with me. As secretary of that church, it was my job to hand money. And when I handled that money, I stole part of that money. Now, at that point in my own life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt my only hope was God. I had just had a spiritual experience, and I turned to God for help. and I ended up seducing his minister and ripping off his church. So I truly know the feeling of hopelessness that they share about in the Big Book. You know, when I got to this program, I heard that laughter was healing, but I always thought my story was just much too serious. And when I got here, I used to hang out at the back of the room. And I have a friend named Teddy. She calls the back of the room the half-measure section or the denial section. And I didn't hang out back there for either of those reasons. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. And I was terrified that they would ask me to read something. And I literally could not say the word anonymity for over 6 months. So I was always hiding out in the back of the room. And in California, it's very theatrical. We have some really funny speakers, and everybody would just burst into laughter. And I was incapable of laughing. For about 2 years, I was incapable of laughing. And I thought this was really serious stuff, and I didn't understand their laughing. But 2 years into my sobriety, I'm back in the back of the room, and somebody said something from the podium, and I laughed. And I had a huge belly laugh, and it just felt so good. I had never experienced laughing like that. But afterwards, I found myself thinking that might be funny for you, but there's nothing, absolutely nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. And then I don't know how many years ago, it was my second time to ever give an AA talk. I never shared my story till I was 11 years sober. My second time to give an AA talk, and my daughter wanted to come hear me. Now, my daughter suffered a terrible tragedy in sobriety. She was kidnapped from an AA dance, brutally raped, and almost murdered. And so she was in and out of the program, in and out of the program. This is the time she was trying to get back into the program. And she heard I was talking, and so she wanted to come hear me. She brought some of her program girlfriends over to my house, and we had coffee before the meeting. And she proceeded to tell her girlfriends my drug log. And it was just the first time I was ever able to laugh at anything. For some reason, it was just a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head. And of course, she's telling these girls all about the minister, you know, and I never thought how these things look through the eyes of a 9-year-old. She was 9 years old when I was seeing this minister. So she's telling these girls, I'm dragging her off to church every day, and she's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. I'm constantly preaching all this religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and opens the bedroom door, and they're naked in bed with her mom, with the married minister of the church. When she first said that, I just felt all this shame, all this guilt and embarrassment. And I looked at my daughter, and in the most sympathetic way, I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. And she just looked at me and, oh, sorry. She just looked at me and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. Up until that time, I totally forgot he had an artificial leg. It was a big leg. I don't know how I forgot it. Oh, my goodness. But in ways that were important, he was not disabled. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me, besides step 12, the most important step for me was step 9. Even though I'm going to go into 10, I love 10 because 10 really covers 4 through 9. Actually, it was 4 through 12. But I call step 9 the freedom step. This is the step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past. And it's just not a coincidence that in the Big Book, those promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. You won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9, thank God, because it took me 12 years. But that started for me when I did my very first amends, and that was going back to that church. Telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds, and he told me he knew that. And I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. Then I had to tell him I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower, and he told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him. But the neat thing about this experience is he shared with me at that time, he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience, which led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober at church. And I'm not putting down churches, and I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because Bidwith makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. But I have to tell you, for me, it was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So I'm kicked out of this church. I'm living in an apartment I'm being evicted from. My lights and gas had been turned off for a long time, but I still had a telephone. It was a working priority. I got a call at 11 o'clock at night, and I couldn't believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. I barely knew his name was on my birth certificate. He wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family. And I didn't want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him. But mostly I didn't want to move to the snow. But at that point in my life, I didn't have anywhere to go except for out on the streets. So I moved there to Colorado for 3 months. And in that 3 month period, this man and his family could not wait to get me out of Colorado. In that 3 month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his food cabinet, ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. So my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote him a letter, and I told him I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still wanted to make, I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule. Basically, what he and the family did is they sent the check back to me with a little note that said they didn't want my money and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober. But I really did want to make these amends. And so with my sponsor's encouragement, on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him an appropriate letter or an appropriate card. And I would tell him I'm still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I still wanted to make restitution for my behavior. I did this for 6 or 7 years and I never got a reply back. Finally, the last time I sent off a card, within a few days, I received something in the mail, and when I saw the return address on that envelope, I cannot tell you how excited I was. And I ripped open that envelope, and the only thing that was in the envelope was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary on the newspaper. He just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't. But I took it real, real hard. People in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me, I don't make amends for approval. The Big Book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked. Because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he did not get to know the person I am today. So just fast forward about my drinking. I'm a home drinker. I don't have any friends of my own. I ended up drinking vodka down so much so fast that I stopped breathing, had to be rushed to the hospital and resuscitated or brought back to life or whatever. And, you know, that scared me. That really scared me. And I didn't want to do to my daughter what I'd experienced, all the police, all the drama, all the ambulances. I didn't want to do that to her, so I finally started listening to her. She would tell me on a daily basis, she would say, Mom, if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things. She said, just smoke pot. So this is my only experience smoking pot, but I'm trying really hard not to drink that day. I'm smoking this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight, tight jeans, and I have my hands stuck down in my pockets. Now, I don't know if you've been on pot, but for me, it was different. I have to tell you, I had the feeling, well, first of all, I tripped. And I don't know if I tripped over my foot or cracked, but I started to go down. And I had the feeling that I was going down in slow motion. And I also had this sensation that the cement was coming up at my face. And no matter what I did, and I tried really hard, I could not get my hands out of my pockets. So you have to picture a grown woman laying there with her face smashed with cement. Her hands are still sticking out of her pockets, and the gang members were laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. And I could hear them laughing, but as I heard their laughter, I had that moment of clarity. I knew right then and there, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking. And it was not too much longer than that I just reached a point where I just couldn't do it one more day. You know, I woke up feeling those feelings you hear about, facing those hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. naked on my front room floor, and I just took those first three steps, and I didn't even know what they were. I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and my life had never been manageable. I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just didn't think he would, because of what I'd done to the church, and this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I just got on my knees, and I said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And I called a prayer line affiliated with the church I was in, and I asked them to pray for me, because in my mind, I thought if God wouldn't listen to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, maybe he would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days, and within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that got me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how to work. I had a sponsor after I had 6 months of sobriety. She told me I had to be fully self-supporting to my own contributions. And got that first job, and that's where I learned how to work. Stayed there for 10 years. I went on to another job working for a musical theater, and I was there for 6 years. So from the point where I went to work on, you know, a real job, I stayed employed for 16 years. I was not without work for 16 years. I'm on my ninth step, and that's when I started taking the actions that I just shared about of making amends. And what I was told about sponsoring is that it's not quantity of time, it's quality of sobriety. And if you have completed step eight, you're ready to go out there and sponsor. And I know some people think you need a year, but I've got people that are sober today because they got out of themselves at very young age in sobriety and just started helping other people, much like Bill and Bob. Thank God no one told them they had a year. They had to have a year. But no matter how long it takes you to do step nine, which it took me 12 years, you still have to live in 10, 11, and 12. And step 10 is just one of my favorite steps. The two steps I really liked out of the 12 and 12 are step 6 and step 10. But my sponsor had me do my first step 10 out of the 12 and 12 because I had such low self-esteem. She had me every day cast up a balance sheet where I wrote down on one side all my defects for the day and on the other side all my assets for the day. And every day I took that action at night, and I do it in writing because I did my fourth step in writing. And I, too, believe in pen to paper. It says written inventory. And so anyway, so every day the defects got, you know, fewer and the assets got longer. And then I reached a point in this program where that wasn't working for me. And I started doing my 10th step out of the big book, and it's really under step 11. But in the big book, step 10, 11, and 12 are very commingled. And I just want to read one paragraph here for you. It says, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. This should continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Do you know what a relief that was for me, knowing that this should continue for a lifetime? Because I thought I had to be rid of fear. It had to be gone, or I wasn't doing my steps right. And in steps 10 and 11, it clearly tells me this is something that might plague me for the rest of my life. But the deal is, today I walk through it. I don't let it paralyze me. I used to let it paralyze me. And I'm talking this as unreasonable fear. Because some fear is a natural instinct God gave us for our survival. So you don't want to completely to remove fear, or you might do something stupid like, get in a fight with someone who has a knife and you have nothing. So fear serves us at certain times. But it says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. When these crop up, we ask God to remove them at once. To me, if I'm talking to God, that's step 11. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. And that is step 12. But I want you to know that I use that love and tolerance of others as our code as a mantra for years and years and years. I said it continuously when I was driving, continuously after work, and that is something that really made a big change in me. I have a personality, and I'm even keeled. I mean, my husband's the most wonderful man on earth, but he would be difficult to live with, you know, because he just lets all of it out, you know, and I don't take it personal. I don't take it personal. I know it's not about me, and I think it's because I work so hard at practicing love and tolerance of others and just knowing that that's their stuff. It's not mine. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. This is considered the second set of promises. This is a powerful, powerful stuff that we're reading here. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we find that this has happened automatically. We will see how our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. This is our experience. This is how we react as long as we're in fit spiritual condition. Okay, how do you keep in fit spiritual condition? Work and self-sacrifice for others. You can tell I sponsor her. That's how I keep in fit spiritual condition. I can pray and I can meditate and go to church, but if I'm not helping anyone, I'm no earthly good. So work and self-sacrifice for others. The next sentence, it says, it is easy to let up on our spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Now, resting on our laurels, that means resting on our past accomplishments. And we can't stay sober on what we did yesterday. We have to stay sober on what we do today. And I'm going to jump here to just the next page. And this is under step 11. And I'm going to read to you exactly how I do my inventory, my 10th step. Even though it's under the 11th step, it's on retiring at night. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? I write out an answer to that. Do we owe an apology? I answer that. Have we kept something to ourselves, which we should discuss with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? I mean, now it's asking us to look for the good stuff also. I mean, it's a constructive inventory, not destructive. If I was kind and loving toward 90% of the people, I give myself credit for it because the other 10% is covered in the first question. What could we have done better? That has been a powerful tool for me because if I've had something that I don't feel good about that happened that day and I'm ashamed of maybe the way I reacted, I write about it and I write out a scenario of how I could have handled it better. I can't change my behavior unless I know what I can change it to. And so that has been a powerful tool for me. Let's see. Were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the mainstream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. I have that highlighted. Once you have done the work, I believe that you've done the work and you need to try to move on. Because going over it and over it and over it is staying attached to it, taking it back from God. And one thing about our inventory, you know, this book, the way Polly and I do the steps is a way, it's not the way. There's no right way, there's no wrong way. All of us do something different here. It's just do something, you know. And some people burn their inventories and other people don't believe in it. They believe in saving them. I get rid of mine because after step 8, I have to have it for step 8, but I get rid of mine because I feel like I do not need to check up on God and just see what he's done. Let me see how God's done so far. And go back and look at that stuff. I'm really taking it back when I do. That's what I have found for me. I'm taking that stuff back when I go back and check up on God. And on awakening is how I do my my formal prayer and meditation. But I do pray all through the day and at night. But in the morning, I give God, it might be 10 minutes. It's usually a half hour to an hour of time. I don't fit God into the shower. I don't fit God into the drive to work. I don't squeeze him in here and squeeze him in there. I give 100% of that time to God. That's the least I can do. That's the least I can do. And I can pray or I can write letters. I can just be quiet and listen. But the point is, I'm giving that time to God. I know today I've been catapulted into what Bill likes to call that fourth dimension of existence. He talks about it on page 8, and he talks about it on page 25. My favorite page is page 8, where it says catapulted, because it tells you what that fourth dimension is like. And I can tell you today, no matter what's going on in my life, and it's a lot, I still know those feelings of happiness, peace, but best of all today, I know that feeling of usefulness. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name's Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. And by God's grace in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April the 11th of 1977, and for that I am eternally grateful. And thank you. I am so excited to be here, I can just barely stand it. My heroes are here this weekend. And Dick, thank you so much. Barbara, thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of this. Talk about humbling. I look around and I think, you know, the people who have gone before me, what could I possibly have to say? And it's just wonderful. So thank you so much. And I'm going to talk on step 11. And one of the things that that I believe is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous can take a person who is non-functional, mean, whatever, and I'm going to describe myself in that, and absolutely this program can have a psychic rearrangement and a spiritual awakening. And that's what this program has done for me. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am a woman who never, ever should have been allowed to keep her children. And I don't have a lot of stuff to talk about as far as childhood and stuff like that. I mean, if having a loving childhood and being cherished and cared about had anything to do with preventing alcoholism, I should not be sitting here. Because I sponsor women who have had horrific childhoods, and none of that has ever happened to me. My parents absolutely loved and adored me. And, you know, I work with women who have had tragic things happen that their fathers have done to them. And all, I mean, just, you know, torture, child abuse, horrible stuff. None of that happened to me. My daddy was just, I mean, he would take me to a slumber party or something like that. And everybody would say, oh, my God, your dad's so handsome. And he loved me. And not only that, I'm an only child. So I was, now was this perfect in every way? Of course not. I was raised, I always like to hear Ralph talk because he was raised Southern Baptist. And I was raised Southern Baptist. The only difference is, sweetheart, I got to do it in the South. Way different than Los Angeles. And we're in the South, so I don't ever have to explain myself when I come to the South. And I was born and raised in Texas, and I grew up in a Southern Baptist home. And thou shalt not drink, and we didn't. And I truly believe with all my heart, had my dad taken a drink of alcohol, he would have been an alcoholic. Now, I have no proof of that. I just believe that he would have been, because he was a man who was full of rage. And so what happened was, is I had a lot of fear going on about his rage. And I'd look at my parents and my mother. I had two parents who were abused children. And just like an alcoholic and an addict, they found each other. And what happened is my parents had two different reactions to that bringing up. And what happened is my mother was way into herself, very quiet, didn't say anything, she just was a huge caretaker, constantly gave of herself. And my dad was angry. He was a rageful man. And my mom and I would walk around on eggshells. So, you know, that part of my life, I was always trying to be keep things in balance. And when my dad would have one of his fits of rage, I would be going over to my mother. I was setting up for Al-Anon then. And I'd go over to my mom and I'd say, he didn't really mean it, and just try to always be this peacemaker in the family. And it really goes, I'm a Libra, so it really kind of even, I got to have everything kind of evened out here. So that was kind of my bringing up. But what happened was, I was like the worst of both of my parents. And I think I lived in Los Angeles, and I lived in Orange County, and I worked in El Segundo. And if you don't live there, you don't have any idea what kind of a freeway ride that is. But it's huge. And I used to listen to this psychologist on the radio, and she used to say that we act out our parents' pathology so we learn to forgive them. And what I realized about myself is that I was the worst of both my parents. Because on the one hand, I was very shy, very self-conscious, very self-centered, I've learned what that is. You know, I used to think I'm just so shy and so humble, I'm just self-centered. And as I learned it today. And on the other hand, I was angry and rageful. The worst of both my parents. And when I've come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and thanks to the steps, and Ralph, I think I just love what you do with the four step, and I just love what everybody's done here, and Bob, I have the privilege of doing some book studies with Bob, and I just consider that such an honor. I just love to do that. And my heroes, Tom and Sandy and Bob. And you just brought me to my knees this weekend, because I understand, because I'm a child abuser. That's what I am. And my children have had traumatic effects from that. And one of my sons is 50, and the other one is 48. And believe me, there's a lot of healing in both of them, but there's still a lot of reaction to that same kind of bringing up. And both of my children have huge marital problems. I wonder why. I mean, they had me for a mother. And both of my sons, they just sort of bend under to women because they had me for a parent. And I'd love to say that, my husband was part of this and all of that. But I was married to a military man. And the longer I'm in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am so grateful that I had that privilege of being married to him. Because I see now that he was doing something that I so believe in today. And that was he served. He served his country. Now, what happened because he served is he was gone for years at a time. And that's a good thing, and it's not a good thing. It's hard on the family when stuff like that happens. But the other thing is, I will tell you today, and what's going on in the wars we're in today, my husband was gone, but nothing like the deployments we have today. Nothing like that. not gone 18 months homesick, 18 months homesick. Six. He was not gone that much. And but today I have a lot of admiration for what he did for his country to serve. But what happened was, is I was left with these two little boys, and they were not left with in good care. They were left with somebody who was very harmful to them. And when you keep saying, "You don't hurt kids today." Me neither, Bob. I don't hurt kids today. And I don't slap kids, and I don't pull their hair, and I don't do any of that stuff that I used to do. And I couldn't even imagine doing anything like that to one of my five grandchildren. So when I talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have had a psychic rearrangement and a spiritual awakening. I am not the woman that I was when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when my son talks, he's in the program. What I love about James is he said, "I could see with my own eyes what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for my mom. She was not the same woman. I knew it worked because I watched what this program did for my mom." And what happened was, is I came here really hopeless. And I was hopeless in the fact that, if you're raised Southern Baptist and you have all of those thou shalt nots, I felt like there was no way that God would ever, ever forgive me for the person that I was. That he would never forgive me. And I know today from so many people that I have had. I mean, the first time I really heard you describe what happened to you, Tom, and I told you that yesterday, was the forgiveness. I mean, the biggest word we have here is forgiveness. And I think of a hero that's passed on, Ed M. I loved Ed as he talked about forgiveness and how we forgive here. And one of the things that has happened is I am so grateful for the gift of forgiveness, because my sons have forgiven me. And what they've been through has been tremendous. And when I came here, I felt so hopeless that God is not going to love a person like me. You can't do what I do and have God love you. And then I get sober and I start acting out sexually because I want you to love me. That's what I want. I feel like if you'll just love me enough, I'll be okay. If you'll just love me. And God just seems so far away from me. But thanks to the chapter to the agnostic, and I am so grateful for this big book and for Bill and the supposedly hundred men and women before us that wrote it, that they wrote that chapter. Because what they did is make God approachable. And when I was 5 years sober, I've married the man of my dreams, and Dave is such a good man. I'm telling you, he's my greatest cheerleader. And those of you who know, I sponsor a lot of women, and I travel a lot, and he just... You know, one time somebody called and on the phone, and Dave says, "Well, somebody's on the phone and they want you to speak somewhere." And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to call them and tell them I can't do that." And Dave says, "What?" And I said, "Well, I'm just gone so much. I just feel like I need to stay home and I need to, you know, be here." And Dave said, "You can't do that." He says, "Yeah, I like for you to be home too, but look at our life. Because of what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for us. And that is such a small price to pay for what we've been given in this program." And I look around and what I've been given in this program. And the greatest thing that I've been given is the relationship I have with God. Because God was so scary to me. God, I knew for sure that Alcoholics Anonymous was not going to help. I was going to burn in hell. That was what was going to happen to me. Because people who do what I do do not get to stay sober. First, I'm commit. You know, I've abused my children. Then I get sober and I'm committing adultery all over the place. I'm already a thief. I'm a liar. I'm still a liar. I have to watch that like crazy. And because my kids tell me I exaggerate, you know, and I think that's a polite way to say you lie a lot. But what happens is those are the things, and I just knew that God would not be available to me. But I'm very blessed. When I was 5 years sober, I got to meet Chuck Chamberlain. And Dave and I had moved to Southern California. And at the time, my sponsor was married to a man that was around Chuck all the time. And we were there. I got to go to Laguna, and I got to sit, you know, and look out onto the ocean from where he sat. He'd sit in that chair, and he was very sick at that time. And I got to read A New Pair of Glasses. And that's when Chuck would say, you know, people are doing the best they can. If they knew better, they'd do better. And he said, a person is only doing as good as much as enlightenment as he has. And I love that. It was either Tom or Sandy or Clancy, one of the three last night, that was talking about that. And what happened was I had to learn to forgive myself for being the person that I was. And I had to forgive myself for the mother I had been. If God had forgiven me, how arrogant of me to sit and stay in morbid reflection and remorse. And my son likes to say to me, oh, Mom, you just think that was all so bad. He says, nobody poured alcohol down me. He says, maybe I have a little bit of fear of strong women. But other than that, you know, you didn't cause any of that. But what happens is I had to learn to forgive myself. And that was a really difficult thing. And today, you know, I get the opportunity to work with women who have had who have been like me. And I get to work with people who've suffered a lot of depression. I was listening to the depression and what happens, because I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I had all this depression. And I found an antidote for depression, and it's called working with others. You know, the more you serve, the more you work with others, the less I'm depressed. I'm just one of these people in Alcoholics Anonymous who cannot spend 1 minute thinking about myself. That is not a good place to go. I'm just one of those people. Now, so when it comes to step 11, this is, in fact, when I got sober and I was 5 years sober, I had a license plate. I had a vanity plate in Southern California, and it said step 11. Because this step means so much to me. And God, I came to believe that God could love a person like me. And I truly believe what was said last night, and that you said it, Ralph, that, you know, God loves the murderers and the rapers and all the people just as much as he loves me. And the good news is today I have more enlightenment than I had. I don't hurt kids anymore. I don't do that anymore. I don't hurt people anymore. And one of the things I've learned in Al-Anon is that hurt people hurt people. And what happened is that's what I did. And most of the time, but what has happened as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and these steps, you should see the parents my sons are. It is amazing. It is absolutely amazing, the parents my sons are. But what has happened for me with step 11 and step 10, and I kind of do the steps just a little bit different. Michael's so good. She writes stuff. Sometimes she's just so good about what she does. I'm mostly... I'm so sick. Who are we telling? One day somebody says, if you're a really sick alcoholic, you just have to do more. And And some people don't have to do as much as, so those of us you see here that are always at the conferences and that are always speaking and are sponsoring these, all these people, we're the sickest ones because we're the ones who have to do the most. And I'm a real alcoholic, and I don't want to be that person anymore, but I know that she's sitting right there. And it says here, I cannot stay sober and stay sober on my past accomplishments. In other words, I can't rest on my laurels. And I had an old redneck. I got sober in Texas. So we had these old rednecks, you know, in Texas. And I know that Bob and Linda, they go down to Texas a lot. And they are. I mean, that's and all those people you guys hang out with are the people I got sober with. And those were the people who were in my life when I got sober. And I just think about this old guy back here, you know, would come in, somebody come in, and if you were talking about, you know, I got fired today, I got a divorce, or I mean, my wife went off on me, my house burned down, I wrecked my car, and some old redneck's going to be back there saying, well, God gave you about 10 ways to grow today, and you blew them all. And, you know, and that was, you know, that was about the kind of sympathy you got. But what we did was talk about that my sobriety is contingent on the maintenance. And if it's the maintenance, it means I have to do things every day. And I do step 10 for me is, step 10 works for me is that's what I do all day long. And if I end up hurting your feelings or doing something like that, then I try to make amends immediately. And I may call somebody and say, well, this happened and this happened, and my little feelers got hurt. And my sponsor may say, well, I think you need to go make amends to them. What? I didn't, you know, but go do it immediately. And I try to do that all day long with step 10. And step 11, I use as two parts. When I lay down at night, I try to review my day. Was there anybody that I owed an amends and didn't make one to? And I try to look at step. I try to look at my step 11, and I don't write it down. I read it. I think about it because it's in my prayers, and when I pray at night, that's what I do. And then upon awakening, I just kind of like to share that with you because I'm a very simple person. I do AA very basically. I'm a no-frills kind of gal. I do things simply. I do it like the book says. And I sit there quietly. And one of the things I love is I got a 1935 dictionary, and it called meditation at that time contemplation, because I thought to meditate I was going to have to sit and empty my mind, or maybe go to India and sit Zazen, and I thought I was going to have to do all of this stuff. But what I do is a lot like, I hang out with some guys in Ohio and they call themselves Back to the 40s, and I kind of do it like Bill and them did it, and that is have a quiet time. And I don't work anymore, I'm retired. But when I worked, I used to get up at 4:30 in the morning so that I would have, I gave God, I know it's not a lot of time, but I gave God 15 minutes. And I always gave him that 15 minutes. Now, I happen to have an AA sponsor, and Dottie is probably, she loves God. She loves God. And she's shared her God with me. And one of the things that has happened for me is I've gone back to the religion of my childhood. And what happened was is I started going to church with my mother because she liked for me to do that. And what I found out is they weren't saying those things in that church I heard. So what happened was is I'm just one of these people that if, you know, I instead of emphasizing the positive, eliminating the negative, I emphasize the negative and eliminate the positive. So what happened for me is I started to have, you know, an open mind. And what I've learned is I've learned a lot about God and about the God of my understanding. And And what I know about God is that God is all inclusive and he loves us all. And that is, I can't judge anybody's spiritual walk. I absolutely cannot do that. And today, love and tolerance is our code. And I just said, I have a prayer list, and I have people that are on my prayer list. And I read a few non-approved AA readings in the morning, and I read some in the big book, and then I sit. And Bob and I were doing step 11, and Dottie used to say, breathe in God, breathe out doubt. And I do that for about 10 or 15 times. Well, Bob was sitting there one day when we were doing the steps together, and I like your way. I do your way now. And Bob went, breathe in God, breathe out self. So today I breathe out self. And I do that for about 15 minutes. And if I do a guided meditation, which I do at retreats and different things like that, because I love guided meditations, but I always use the steps or the 11th or the St. Francis prayer, the 11th step prayer. But what I try to do is to just breathe, because one of the things that I know is the thing that I have to have from God in order to even begin, and that is the breath. The breath. That's the breath. That's the thing I cannot live without, is the breath. And so I breathe in and I breathe out and I read some, and then I say a prayer list of people that I have. And then I try to go through my day with love and tolerance. Now, I wish I made that all the time, but what I try to do is not to be judgmental. Because one of the things that I believe with all my heart is that everything is exactly as it's supposed to be. Everything is happening exactly as it's supposed to be. Now, I can forget that. And one of the things I've been talking about lately is, I said, you know, my life as I know it has just been, the rug has just been pulled out from under me. And I feel like I didn't really want all this change at 70 years old. I really was not looking for all that. Dave and I built this house in Birch Bay, Washington, and I thought for sure I was going to die there. And, you know, go tell God your plans and watch him laugh. And I thought that's where we were going to stay. And lo and behold, we're not. And here we are. We're moving to Florida. I mean, you know, that's like a big move for two old people. And so anyway, we're doing this. And my youngest son is having all kinds of marital problems. And his children have had some really negative reactions to all this. And I was just agonizing over for him and my grandchildren, and because I so believe in family recovery, and there's been such huge family recovery in my family. And my oldest son, I mean, I've been here 33 years, and my oldest son on October the 31st celebrated 1 year of sobriety. 1 year. And so, I mean, it's like, it's, you know, we never know when the miracle is going to happen. We don't know. And I've known Russ has had a lot of other problems, but I didn't know about the alcoholism, too. So it's just, we don't know when all of this is going to happen. And I was just agonizing over James and the kids and all, and James looked at me, and sometimes, you know, we learn from our children. Children tell us the things we need to hear. And I love my son's program, and I love his faith in God. And mine was kind of wobbling, you know, a little bit. And I was afraid that maybe this was what was happening with the children would, you know, maybe it was not going to be fixable. You know, I just didn't know what was going to happen. And James looks at me and he says, Mom, God either is or he isn't. He is either all things or he's nothing. What is our choice to be? And he said, God is good. Everything about God is good. And if God is good, this is good. This is good. And he says, I don't know what God has in store. The only thing I know to be is the very best dad I can be. And just keep loving them, keep reaching out to them, keep doing the things that a good dad would do. And what happens is, then it's none of my business. My business is just to be a good dad. And so I just had to take a breath and realize that my job is just to be a good mom. My job is to be a good mother-in-law. My job is to be a good grandma. That's my job. And all the rest of the stuff is none of my business. And I can remember Chuck C. saying that my life is none of my business. That's God's business. My business is doing for God's kids what needs being done. That's my business. And when I leave my life in God's hands and realize that He's in charge, then my life goes really good. Now, this has been a kind of a hard year with trying to sell a house in a market where houses don't sell. Well, let me tell you something. We sold our house. We had two pieces of property to sell, and we sold both of those pieces of property. Did we make any money? No. But you know what happened is? I'm watching people I sponsor, people I know in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, having to leave the keys in the door and walking away from their homes because they can't sell them and they can't pay for them. But that didn't happen to me. And so what we're going to do is we're going to move to Florida, because that's where old people go because it's cheap. That's where we're going. And you know what? I can't hardly wait because Sandy's down there and Lee's down there and all of these fabulous people are down there. And Michael's in Georgia. Michael's in Georgia. So God's in His heaven and all is right with the world. It's just the way it's supposed to be. And what happened was, is Dave and I were in this position in 1993. And I want you to know, my husband is, you know, sometimes I want to be like him when I grow up. And we left that title company, and it was a heartbreak. I'm telling you, it was a heartbreak. But we left that title company, and all Dave said was, well, we did better this time than we did last time. Because last time, they repossessed the house, and we had to file bankruptcy. That's what happened in 1993. This time, that didn't happen. So you see, all is right. All is right. God's in charge. Sometimes I don't understand it, but if I were big enough, if God were small enough for me to understand, He wouldn't be big enough to do the things He does. And I know for me what my job is. My life is none of my business. That's God's business. My business is to do for God's kids what God's kids need doing. And I know that what it says on page 14, that the way I'm going to grow spiritually is working with others. Working with others. And so when the phone rings, the answer is yes. And when somebody asks, do they need a sponsor, the answer is yes. I don't know about having too many or too much or all of that. I know Clancy said in Cocoa Beach the last time we were together, somebody asked him, they were having a question and answer, and they asked him, how many people do you sponsor, Clancy? And he said, I'm one short. So today I know that God's not going to give me any more than I can handle because I don't do it anyway. It's none of my business. And I'm just so grateful to be here, and I love you all, and thank you for the opportunity.